Now I'm glad to welcome Konrad Becker, who is an Austrian artist, and I'm sure almost everyone in this room will know him. Please sit down for just to introduce you. Konrad, he's co-founder and director of Public NetBase from 1994 to 2006. He's director of the Institute for New Culture Technologies, T0, and co-founder of worldinformation.org, a cultural intelligence provider. He has been active in electronic media as an author, artist, composer, as well as a curator, producer, and so on. Recently, Konrad founded a new cultural formation, the GSA, the Global Security Alliance, which offers cultural security and peacekeeping services. So, just a short question. What was the reason for your change from the net culture to the security business?
Well, it's the business opportunity, of course. You know, we're in a world war against invisible enemies, and so there's lots of work to be done.
Yeah, I studied the GSA website, and there I read that the GSA has established a global presence and provides training and operational solutions for the 21st century. So, who are your clients and which services do you offer?
Well, we offer a broad range of services, really, mainly strategic communication and different forms of cultural peacekeeping. There's a few clients that we can name that you will find on our websites, industry, governments,
So, it's good business. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, Konrad, now it's your turn. His presentation has the title Cultural Peacekeeping in the Theaters of Possessions.
All right. Thank you. So, yes, I will give a short run through some of the techniques of cultural peacekeeping, and the point is that to maximize security, we will have to minimize life. And so there's, it's obviously security is a mindset, and we will talk about the dual use of cultural technologies, technologies of multiplication, of replication, that change reality, that have, deep consequences for our biosphere, and technology that kills the difference between copy and original. And obviously, we're talking about information as a recycled composite of culture, and questions of identity and control that are related to restrictions management or liberation of the copy. And again, the virtual doppelganger of technology for maximizing security. We're talking about the fact that today every noise becomes an image of subversion. And if we look at the early technologies of replication at print, it was already a dangerous business for pamphleteers to actually end up on the gallows. It was quite life-threatening to go into this business of print. And today we have digital networks for human empowerment being used as weapons of mass exclusion. So people being alarmed by ideas or images taking on a life for themselves create mass graves of ideas, basically in the walls of corporate portfolios and IPR regimes of exclusion against the autonomy of memory. It's a restriction management which is based on the variables of patterning access and entries across thresholds. And what we see that beyond, the spectacle of representation, we have now, beyond making believe, the imposed silence. So we have, you know, instead of the neurotic mindset of the spectacle, we have patterns of depression, tales from the crypt, and it's about, again, cultural peacekeeping in the, you know, wars of public paranoia. And let us just have a short look back into the origins of digital simulation technology. Actually, media is a spook story to begin with, so it starts with necromantic mirror worlds and magic lanterns for conjuration devices that are then turned into the first pre-digital simulation technologies, the ghost drama of the phantasmagoria, which means I speak illusions. It's like a complex system of embedded magic lanterns that are moving. The dead return after the French Revolution. There was a kind of a resurrection a la carte service by the French priest and painter Robertson. And it was like a complex scenario of, you know, smoke, dry ice, semi-transparent screens, moving lanterns, sound effects. It was the original smoke and mirrors, and actually on the benchmark of virtual reality, it had some quite high scores. It was working with smell, sound, actually with electric currents in your seating. So a very early form of telepresence. And later we see that again, the dead incarnate into new technologies. We have a new media seance. So there was actually spirit materialization. This was the big genre of photography when it actually came up. There were stars traveling all over Europe producing ectoplasma in large amounts. They actually, you know, they had a big following. They were quite attractive, these people. So they were metamediums. They were mediums working the medium. Here is some more ectoplasma, and it actually found its way into the Oxford English Dictionary. It's something that can be formed or molded. Again, the whole history of cinematography is actually colonized by the undead, as you can easily see from the beginning on. And today, again, you know, if you watch TV, the dead speak to us. There's like high technology, you know, the screen is glowing, and high technology being used to make dead bodies speak. So, it's obviously the dawn of the dead, but this goes on, you know, with the invention of electricity or the discovery of the electromagnetic field with Samuel Morse telegraph. There was a whole movement which can be seen as a complex adaptation to modernity, constructing beliefs, scientific beliefs of the dead in contact with the living. Someone like Nikola Tesla, the inventor of all things electric, was believing seeing the universe as a kinetic system, actually hidden, connecting to hidden worlds. And his nemesis, Mr. Edison, he was actually busy building a radio to contact the dead. So this is a quote from him, but not only him, Marconi himself was also trying to build a radio to speak with the dead. And then in the 60s, this became a huge popular movement, some bestsellers being written on radio contact with the dead. You see some of the protagonists up there with their, you know, with their material. And basically what the idea was that, you know, static is actually filled with the voices of the dead. So, you know, you can see some examples here, not just in audio, but in visual. And so the same technology that is being used to actually make the dead speak, it's being used to silence the living. So sampling is an act of appropriation and potentially aggression. It's just the other way around, so it's dual use. This is about mimetic technology, and mimetic technology is essential for symbolic interaction. It's a means of communication, of course, and representation of rehearsing skills and communicating them. It's an analog to gravity in cohesion of groups. It shapes social systems. It's fundamental to understand the intentions of others. And the unconscious processes of imitation and mimesis are actually related to processes of rivalry and victimization. And there is a danger in this copy that it actually captures the genuine of the original and magically transmitted, you know, to the copy. And then this desire is not really directed toward material objects only, but it's actually directed to the other's being or the source of his power. So that's the danger of mimesis. And again, repetition, the technology of repeating, is an element of lifestyle contagion. There is a psychic epidemic of dance that actually is described by a guy called Ishmael Reed. There has been many dance craze and epidemics over the centuries, also in Europe. And music is not just a bonding agent of with strong feelings, but actually the capacity to follow rhythm and song can only be, you know, understood on this mimetic faculty. And basically, this internalization and acting out of a melody is very similar to what we would call spirit possession. So, music is a simulacrum of the sacrifice. Music is controlled and restricted sound, while noise, raw noise, is an image of violence. And so, without music, no state could survive, as Molière was saying, but Plato was saying pretty much the same in his Republic. And Jacques Attali is saying that, you know, it was no longer necessary to carry out ritual murder to dominate. It's enough, you know, to enact order in noise. So it's a substitute for religion. It's panic control. And in an idealized humanity, you know, you have this hierarchical, harmonious musical system where, you know, conflict and dissonance is excluded, and actually the blurring of differentiation is perceived as violence as such. It's the cult of the dead, and let's look at the theaters of possession, which are an arena of dead. And what is spirit possession? It's basically the concept that a person is believed to be under the control of an external force. One will, one consciousness is being replaced by a spirit, for instance. So then again, this mimesis of the dead is a mechanism of descent in itself. So you can see here that the simulation of a lifeless body actually links authority and death. And if we pass a checkpoint or a portal of authority, you know, you will see this kind of studied casual unconcern in the faces of people, and it has been described to the face of zombies or the face of people getting in trance. So actually passing through these portals is being possessed by the spirit of the state. And Michael Tosic writes, you know, are not these barriers the shrines and magic gateways of the state itself? And one imprudent step could bury us forever. So, demonic possession is about behavior takeover and self-determination being overridden. You see here a little, you know, picture of a treatment for children of demonic possession in some Christian facility in the United States. And then again, you know, what is it with zombies? Their willpower and speech, you know, they're a little bit challenged with that. Probably nobody has seen a zombie talk to you. So, there is an enigma, you know, related to the zombies. What's actually the difference between the living and the dead? Do we know? So it's identity agents that are related to this, and agents are defined by, you know, acting on their environment, and it's a source of subjectivity and identity. And actually this is slightly in contrast to the idea of identity of being this, you know, individualized, singular locus, but rather we have to understand that it's like a very volatile nexus of social relations and practices, which is not quite understood in the art circles, of course. There, it's the authentic domain of identity, which is connected to possessive cultural collection, you know, where objects become unique, being possessed, and vice versa, share their ritual power with the possessor. So, actually, this unique existence, you know, as Walter Benjamin says, is substituted by a plurality of copies. And on the other hand, we see that all this economic order of transactions of objects actually reshape our selfhood. They reshape our subjectivity. And talking about reshaping our subjectivity. We're talking about multiple avatars, the creation, the artificial creation of personality states, which was an objective in the intelligence ages from the 20s on. And we'll see, you know, there's some Hollywood movies on that, on psychologically programmed assassins. And indeed, people who are supposedly possessed or have a so-called identity disorder, they report amnesia when in control by other personalities. So there is something called the dissociative identity disorder, and that means that two or more distinct personality actually control individual behavior at different times. And however it's, you know, more culturally constructed or a response to trauma, it shows that actually with strong social pressure and deep psychological influence, there can be the creation of these avatars, the splitting up of personalities, and automatons and somnambulists obviously play a role in the anxious representation of, similar to the cyborg, where hybrid identities, you know, across domains of flesh, machine, technology, gender, etc. And in the end, the self itself becomes a ghost. So, fictitious memory, it's about, you know, it has been mentioned today, you know, we're unconscious more or less of what we're not aware of, and it's clear that the experience of our conscious will is not causally related to our, you know, thought, between thought and behavior. It can be very much easily demonstrated in hypnotic suggestions. So actually, the confabulation of intention is not the exception, but really the rule, and intent is largely invented after the fact. So there are structural exploits for that, and people revise their attitude to justify their actions afterwards. It's a ghost in the machine where we're not so much doing what we're willing, but we experience our will consistent with what we do. And this is like a neurocognitive experiment that shows that actually it takes a while, you know, to process a stimulus, and actually our mind constantly subtracts and predates subject experience up to half a second to what's actually happening out there. So there's a blind spot, and we do not become aware of that, but and our perceptual system is sort of constantly lagging behind, never catching up, and having to, you know, cover up this lack with fiction, of course. So it's a memory hallucination where we, you know, experience ourselves at the same time of the stimulus, and it's related to attention. And attention, you know, is not just the base of the attention economy, it's a key to non-tangible forms of power and coercion. And again, attention is directly linked to its opposite. So we will see to perceptual disintegration. We will see if you fix the gaze, we will have strained eyes. We will get a blurred vision. If we try to keep awake, we'll actually get very tired, dazed, and confused. So with an extremely heterogeneous mixture, you know, of fragmentations constantly crossing in our mind, in the end, the past slips away, that it creates the illusion of change, but really, nothing is ever happening, and that's why the future is so hard to predict. So there is no original experience, you know, unfortunately, to refer to. It doesn't make a difference to hallucination or any of that. And obviously the attention economy produces market failures. It's the attention deficit disorder which is coming up, which is related to a general mindset of diffuse anxiety. And then we're mixing with objects. You know, the blurred boundaries between subjects and objects in the world of fetishes, it's like objects invested with meaning that start to talk. So it's a nature-culture continuum with very fuzzy boundaries between people and things. And, you know, you can see that in what has been called commodity fetishism of attributing human powers to objects, where actually it results in social organization forms which seem totally independent of any human will. And the body actually itself, you know, is the primary fetish in a classic economic theory. It's a thing possessed by a mind in itself. It's like the body snatcher's theme. And again, this nature-culture hybrids, they bypass the duality of immanence, transcendence, of manufacturing or discovering. And obviously, you know, these fetishes are actually in motion. And while they're in motion, they're mediating and transforming identities and relations and actually create institutions of power and knowledge. And as Emmanuel Castell is saying, that this whole logic of, you know, the economy, it's not controlled by capitalists or corporations. And while they still exist, you know, they're all determined by the automaton. So this automaton is not the market. It does not follow market rules. It's actually a monster from beyond. Bruno Latour, you know, says that this monster, this thing that we're looking for, is not a human thing, it's not an inhuman thing, it's rather a continuous passage, an interchange between what humans inscribe it in and what it prescribes to humans. It's weird things all over, you know, objects take on agency, quasi-objects populate the world, and the dominant divides between subject and object come into question. A quasi-object like a ball in a game, which is also an example Bruno Latour gives, even if it does not. Let's look at the question of property. You know, surveillance is obviously to secure property. Property does not even exist before establishing its identity of the owners, of actually creating a system of meaningful relation between object and controller. And it's a Roman concept, you know, which became a structuring principle of capitalism. And interestingly enough, this concept was basically of, you know, taking control of public land. So property politics, you know, when the modalities of property differentiated the function of property as a means of controlling the lives of other became dominant, and it became a religious thing. Actually, the ideology of property had its peak in the 19th century, when the original ideas about property became totally obsolete, like the control of land and the things on it. So actually, property becomes a weapon of dominance, a weapon of possession. And today, in the, you know, in the regimes of intangible assets, it's about the control of ideas. So it's about the possession of mind. You see here, this is like Wonder Woman. She had this lasso, and if you know, she catches you, you have to speak the truth. And the guy who invented it, he was also the inventor of the polygraph or the lie detector. And so this is the tools of the psychic data lords. You know, the ghosts of intellectual property and the haunted mansion of voodoo economics. And it's, you know, unless it's not the ownership of the media, it's actually ownership by media. Not possession of media, but possession by media. And so the whole technology, you know, blurs obviously the boundaries between what is actually counterfeit and what is real. So, you know, you can make technological copies that are actually better than the original. So forgery is really about authorship and not about content. And actually forgery meant originally just to make and nothing else. And so the sacred aura of the unique, you know, it's related to the cult of beauty in the bourgeois social order. And actually, you know, some art forges have become quite popular, and you know, high culture counterfeit currency is often a source of popular amusement, but you know, it's not a victimless crime. Actually, it alters official authorized history, and it you know, alters collective identity. The subtle distortions of reality and the corruption of ideas is actually compared to aliens living you know, undetected amid us. So this invasion of alien doubles infiltrating and altering codes is obviously also related to plagiarism. It's necessary in contrast to the reactionary ideology of individuality and ownership. It's always about social processes of shared interactions, and plagiarism attacks the concept of, you know, the sacred possession of elites, simply because anybody can plagiarize, and the construction of milieus. So it's about libidinal economies and bonding with the spirits in the dynamics of post-industrial economics, a demonology of commodity that is driving the stocks and bonds and the financial markets in an exchange and consumption. It's not a production-based economy, really, but of desires bound that are exploiting the logic of desires, harnessing a desire in cultural perception. And it's the symbolic feudalism in the flesh with the public relations image control of the public imagination, reinvesting capital into bondage and fetishization, and actually the disembodied possession. So it's the flexuous, libidinal body that's actually never identifiable by what it desires. Again, power is encrypted in public state secrets, you know, where the sacred actually connects with the secrecy in strange ways, because power has become occult, hidden in financial flows, technologies, images, etc. And we see the corporate magic working, you know, its magic with the invisible hand, and the secret of multinational firms hiding behind nation states, actually, like in this game that you know with this little, what's the name? Anyway, so behavior adjustment and the new site of power is in people's mind, as everybody knows. And disclosing these modes of manipulation is obviously similar to violating a state secret. And what we see that this psychotechnologies, they have a history of, you know, the 19th century. I mentioned the spiritualist so-called pseudoscience, the psychotechnicians of emergent modernity trying to objectify human subjectivity. And it's actually, you know, the psychological parameters. A lot of that, what we see in today's forensic science, applied psychology, criminology, has its root in this sort of occult, dark, murky waters, you know, psychoanalysis, which helped to spawn modern public relations. It actually is still struggling for a scientific status, so it has been very effective, but it's a pseudoscience, of course. And personality assessment systems are actually much more successful, being introduced in the 60s by intelligence agencies that are now big in all the in the industry. And scientific shadowlands, you know, they're all to be found in the social theories and optimization of the workplace theories of the 20th and 21st century. And when we talk about deep psychological operations, it's not this idea of, you know, omnipotence of thought, but it's actually pragmatic action in a world where thought and reality are never really, you know, distinguished anyway. And we're talking about the terror of the double, of the unique. So originality as a you know, modernism's claim to the dynamism of innovation that we hear in this festival so many times, it's actually ancestor worship gone wrong. So it's a, you know, it's a cult of the dead. And this mythic aura of authenticity is based on religious beliefs regarding contact with a unique source. And information does have strange properties. It's actually doubles by sharing it. And again, you know, this is a quote from the guy from the WIPO. You know, he says that piracy is like terrorism today, and it exists everywhere. And this disturbance of the boundary of original and copy is actually seen as terrorism. So sharing is a crime, of course, and the copy and its double, you know, it has some uncanny consequences. And a rendition is not an imitation of reality, but actually a reality for itself. So, you know, some of you know this copyrighted figure. Most of you don't know that it's a North African demon. On the left, you can see a picture from a medieval church. It's about 800 years old. Below on the left is a picture which is 900, an object which is 900 years old. And on the right, you see Rafa, being used in the Hamas television. So we don't really know some of the things that are going on with this, but we know there is a tradition of dissent. Free spirits, you know, were involved in dangerous practices that, you know, have challenged the imperatives of an emerging market-based economy, heretical movements from the medieval on, bond slave revolts, which were related in its most radical forms, and some kind of an individual alchemy, and which was targeted at relinquishing the economy's hold over individual millennium subvertising. There's a nice book on the movement of the free spirit, and the whole subject that I'm covering here is related to what I would call strategic reality creation. So that is the end of my talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much, Konrad, for this great performance. And now I think we can need a short break.